Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The frequent flyers out there are probably all too familiar with the flight attendant instructions to please turn off all cell phones and all electronic devices during takeoff and landing. Changes by the Federal Aviation Administration have allowed for the use of electronics throughout the flight, and proposed changes at the FCC might allow for cell phone use in the friendly skies. Joining us now to discuss the possible changes by phone is Cecilia Kang. She's tech reporter for The Washington Post. Welcome back to the show, Cecilia.
Hello.
So FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler has said that the rule banning calls is out of date. Can you remind us what the thinking was behind the ban on cell phone calls in the first place?
Sure. In the first place, the ban was put in place about 20 years ago, more than 20 years ago, on a technical basis, because there were concerns 22 years ago, actually, that the radio signals emitted from devices could interfere actually with the operation of the plane. So it could really be a safety hazard. So that was the reasoning behind them. But Tom Wheeler, the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, as you said, he's only a month into his tenure there, decided that, you know, the technology has improved so much that those fears of interference no longer exist.
How long have they not existed? How long have they known, known that
sure.
It didn't matter?
Well, you know, in about 10 years ago, less than a decade ago, this same issue and proposal came up at the FCC with a lot of the same uproar and protest by consumers and flight attendants and et cetera as well. And the same arguments were presented there, that technology's improved. It is not really convincing that there's interference from the technology of consumer devices with the operation of a cockpit. But at that time, less than a decade ago, that proposal at the FCC that was similar to the one that was passed last week did not pass because there was such a consumer uproar about it. So it's been around. It's sort of the technological solutions to interference have essentially been around for about a decade.
So last time it didn't pass, the FAA recently changed the rules for electronic devices so we can continue, you know, Angry Birds while the plane takes off. Why? And someone won't get arrested for playing Words with Friends.
Right.
Why is this decision one for the FCC instead of the FAA?
Well, this decision does involve both. But what the FCC has to address and is in charge of regulating is the airwaves, the technology on the plane, and whether it can allow what's known as the spectrum to be used for consumer use on the airplane. And the FAA is involved in that all equipment that is approved for a plane has to go through the FAA approves it. So they are both involved. But the FCC has in some ways been the last stop in preventing phone calls and data use on cell phones on planes because they have not approved the use of the airwaves on planes. And so the spectrum, if you will. So so in that way, it's, you know, the FCC doesn't see itself so much as, it really doesn't have a place in airplanes except for on this technical basis. But they were, in many ways, the last stop from preventing this from happening.
What do they do in other countries?
Well, you know, there is actually Emirates Airways, British Airways, Singapore Airways. They actually do have, these are airlines in Europe and Asia that do allow for cellular phone use on their planes. And, you know, from I talked to Onboard, which is a company that provides Wi-Fi and cellular service on planes, and they say that a lot of the use is not among those airlines is not really for talking.
Mm-hmm.
It's for data use. And earlier, Anne, you were asking, you know, what's why now? Why are we seeing this permission that's happening? I think in some way consumer habits have sort of pushed along government decisions in that you see the ubiquity, how there are cell phones and smartphones everywhere, and passengers are using their smartphones on the planes until the very last moment. And as you noted, they will continue to be able to use their devices during takeoff and landing as far as not the without on the airplane mode, that is, but to play games and et cetera. So just little by little, there's just been more acceptance of electronics on planes, as you know. I mean, the Kindle was a big, you know, being able to use the Kindle on takeoff and landing and during a flight was sort of a push forward in this way. But the decision and the reason why this is so controversial this past week, the FCC's decision, is, you know, the use of technology is not so controversial. It's the idea of having to sit by a passenger, neighbors, right, who are talking on their devices. So doing something that's actually very sort of, you know, sort of old, you know, on new technology, the talking aspect of it is what really concerned flight attendants unions, lawmakers, and consumers being trapped in a cabin and having to listen to somebody's cell phone conversation. It's just so much more invasive than sitting next to somebody who's just emailing on their smartphone. So it's not so much the concern of using the technology or the interference aspects of it, the safety. It's more the annoying factor, if you will.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about cell phones, talking on your cell phone on an plane in flight with Cecilia Kang. She's a Washington Post reporter, covers technology. Right. So this has been an etiquette issue more than anything all over the place.
Yes.
There's some places that ban cell phones in doctor's office, waiting rooms, that kind of thing.
Yes, that's right. I mean, it's interesting. I think we've gone to a point where cell phone use, talking as well as, you know, texting during, you know, in movie theaters and seeing that bright light has, things have gone so far and the use of technology all the time, and it feels like almost everywhere, that you're actually seeing sort of the backlash now. And, you know, doctor's offices banning it, new movie theaters banning, you know, certain cell phone use. And the idea of the airplane, which has seen to many people as a last refuge from chatter.
And you're also captive in the airplane.
Yes. Can you imagine sitting next to two people and having to listen to their business deals or their personal conversations?
I'm definitely one of those people that get on the plane and go, when I'm sitting next to another single person, you know, that's not going to be chattering to the person next to them. I hate to sound antisocial, but that's just a moment of respite. You're right.
That's right. And, you know, and I think the flight attendants and the flight attendants unions sort of say it best, is that they're the ones that actually have to police, if you will, the cabin for behavior, and they're really concerned that this could lead to, like, air rage,
right,
you know? They're concerned that an irritated passenger, you know, you might have irritation from somebody who hogs the armrest or somebody who, you know, sits in the wrong seat or is a crying baby, but, you know, that this they really are afraid of will create a whole nother level of consternation and possibly conflict within in an airplane cabin. So yeah, there's increasing concern that there are no quiet zones, and you are seeing, like, as you mentioned, doctor's offices, air trains on the very, you know, well traveled route from Washington D.C. to New York, the Acela. They have a Amtrak train. They have the business car called Acela. They have a quiet car. And there, it's not like there's any technical limits to using your cell phone, but it's just sort of an understanding and an agreement that whoever sits in that car cannot take calls or place calls, voice calls. And maybe that's the way that they'll go about it at the going forward, because, you know, what was decided last week was quite interesting, Anne, in that the FCC approved the use of cell phones, or at least approved the beginning stages of exploring, if you will, this is very Washington,
right,
the many phases of a regulation, the beginning stages of looking at revamping rules. But the Department of Transportation kind of came to the rescue, listening to all the consumer complaints leading up to this highly watched, closely watched decision at the FCC. The Department of Transportation decided that it would explore its own rules on banning one portion of it, and that is the voice calls.
All right. So what about the airlines? What do they say?
You know, what's so interesting is that some of the airlines have said that they're not interested in adopting this service. they say this, and it'll be interesting to see if they carry this out. We see Delta has said that it will prohibit cell phone use. Southwest says that it opposes cell phone conversation. But American Airlines and, you know, some other airlines said that they're going to watch and see what happens. The airline industry consultants say that this could be a real opportunity for airlines to make more money, really, to generate revenue. They see a service that they can sell in this.
A premium for the seat. Yeah.
Exactly. You can pay a premium to go to a quiet zone.
Well, I was going to say you pay a premium to go to a noisy zone. If you want to talk on your phone, you have to pay more.
I think, Ann, I had the more cynical take on it, right?
Oh,
you have to pay a premium
geez.
To go to a quiet zone.
Crap.
So that is, exactly. So that is one, thought. Singapore Airlines has a quiet zone where babies aren't allowed. So, where you pay a premium to go to that quiet zone if you don't want to listen to babies crying. So some people point to that as an example of how they can sort of slice and dice. You see that airlines are really, picking apart like different aspects of the flying experience and monetizing it from, boarding earlier to a little bit more legroom to mm-hmm. checking your bags earlier or later, all these things that used to be just perfunctory
right.
parts of the airline experience are now being sliced and diced in ways to make more money.
Is there any way to permit texting, which is the really big thing, and disallow talking?
Yeah, that is definitely what the Department of Transportation hopes to do. Transportation Secretary Anthony Fox said last week that, again, very, very vaguely worded, I'm going to explore, some sort of a rule that will prevent the talking aspect of cell phone use. How that can happen, it'll be difficult. I think technologically, I'm sure that there can be some sort of technology that can be created that can block certain aspects of cell phone. But, then you'd have to get cell phone manufacturers to, produce this and the software companies. It may just be an agreement that, if you're on the plane, you're not allowed to use to place voice calls, mm-hmm. but you can text and email and use the web browser and apps. There's also the question of, what's to prevent use from using Skype then,
yeah.
and placing voice calls. So there's so much to be worked out on this. And I think that the Federal Communications Commission, in really trying to be a 2013 agency and saying, there's no technological reason for cell phones not to be allowed on planes anymore, they really opened up a can of worms.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We'll let Richard in his email have the last word, I guess. If I could think of the next big idea for making flying a miserable experience, it would be being in the middle of two people trying to talk over each other on cell phones. I'd be tempted to carry a sharp object. We will not give Richard's last name out. Cecilia King, though, thanks for joining us. We'll catch up with you on this later.
Thank you so much.
Cecilia King, she's a Washington Post tech reporter. Coming up, we'll be talking about a new report on electronic waste, how much we're creating and where it all ends up. So we'll be right back with Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. It is that time of year when many of us are hoping to get a new phone, maybe a tablet or television as a present. Getting a new high-tech gift can be exciting, but that usually means that the old technology goes in the trash or, best case, in a recycling center, maybe the one we just mentioned. Concerns about all this electron waste has been growing, and a new report reveals that keeping track of just how much waste is out there is part of the problem. Joining us now by phone from MIT is Reed Miller. He's a research specialist at MIT's Materials Systems Lab and a co-author of the new report. Welcome.
Oh, thanks so much. Great to be here.
The name of the report you co-authored, Quantitative... Quantitative characterization of domestic and transboundary flows of used electronics. In layman's terms, what was the goal here?
Well, basically, There's certainly a growing interest in used electronics and trying to figure out what does happen to them, how are we managing them. But the problem is there's really limited data in that space. So our goal here was centering around the exports of these used electronics. Of course, there's concern about how they might be managed if sent to a developing country where proper safety guards aren't put in place. And then we also estimated the domestic flows of used electronics for a comparison point.
The paper was released in conjunction with a new online map that displays e-waste information. The map comes from the STEP initiative. Can you tell us what that is and how it relates to your work?
Well, I sure can. So the STEP initiative is the Solving the E-Waste Problem initiative, and that's based out of the United Nations University. And what they're trying to do is get a global picture of how much used electronics are really being generated. And they want to be able to do consistent country-by-country comparisons. They're looking at basically everything with a cord, whether it's an electronic, whether it's a refrigerator, and we're also working in partnership with the STEP initiative, but for our work, we chose to have a more narrow scope, and we really wanted to focus on the U.S. and look at computers, monitors, TVs, and mobile phones.
By the way, that organization that's seeking used computers, it's called Assistive Technology of Ohio, and we'll put a link on our website at wosu.org/allsides. When
Great.
We talk about e-waste, What are we talking about?
Well, that's a great question. Well, e-waste is a popular term that many people have heard, but we actually prefer to use the term used electronics because really, unless an item is going to end up in the trash or be improperly managed, there's still a good deal of value in most of the components or in the materials or, in the best case, for its reuse for another life. So broadly, e-waste is usually referring to when someone is done with an electronic or a business is done with an electronic, then it becomes e-waste. But hopefully we can divert it from one of those lesser fates and get it into the recycling and reuse streams.
Okay. So we have a horrible picture up on our website of just hundreds and hundreds of computers and junk like that. Fax machines, printers, everything piling up.
Mm-hmm.
How much e-waste is the United States creating?
So we focused our report around the year 2010, and our methods can be used to forecast. And looking in the year 2010, talking about computers, monitors, TVs, and phones, we estimated that there were about 260 million units, and that's almost 2 million tons generated. And so that's some of those ended up in recycling, while a good portion of those also ended up in the landfill.
Was that just in 2010?
That was just in the year 2010. That's right. So, and as we're seeing, you know, as you mentioned, people interested in the shiniest new technology, the sales are certainly going to grow. And what we're going to see, though, is that the composition of what's making it either into the landfill or into the recycling stream is going to change as the popularity of different products changed. You know, there's certainly a trend going towards tablets versus mm-hmm. laptops.
Mm-hmm. And there's different material in that.
Absolutely, yeah. Each sort of technology has a standard set of components. And tablets, you'll see, you know, that batteries really make up the bulk of them, whereas in laptops, you know, the battery is certainly a component, but it's also got a very large motherboard and other electronics in there.
What have been the biggest challenges in getting an accurate picture of how much e-waste we produce? It's not so much that we produce, it's what we buy, right? And get rid of.
Yeah, well, fortunately, there is pretty good data on the sales because, you know, technology companies are certainly interested in knowing how much is on the market. Mm-hmm. But there hasn't been as much in terms of tracking what comes out of homes, because, you know, you and I aren't required to fill out a report every time we're done with a laptop, and businesses aren't either. And recycling companies, though they're frequently surveyed by a variety of organizations about the volumes that they process through their facilities, unless they're involved in a state recycling program, they're really not required to report that information. So basically, we're trying to do the best we can and make estimates based on limited data. One of the ways that we're able to do that pretty well is to combine that sales data with widespread consumer surveys so that we can infer based on their behavior what's happening to these electronics.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm speaking with Reed Miller. He's a research specialist at MIT Materials System Lab. They have studied how much e-waste is out there in the United States and what's being done with it. If you have a question or comment for him, you can go to our website at, you can email us at allsides@wosu.org or give us a call, 614-292-8513. Where is it all going now?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we're seeing that of those roughly 260 million used electronics that I mentioned in 2010, about 170 million of those in 2010 were actually collected for recycling or reuse. And so the companies that are doing the collection are likely going to do some sort of a triage, and they're going to say, okay, this product, does it have reuse value? Because they're going to want to get the highest value of it and then sell it back to someone else after tuning it up a bit. If not, maybe they'll disassemble it and take out some of the high-value components for resale. Or if not, then they'll put it through a shredder and recycle those commodities. And a portion of those actually are also being exported to other countries. And that's in part because some countries have better industrial capacity for extracting precious metals, such as the gold that's in the circuit boards. And in part, it's because the differential in the wages between the U.S. and, say, some developing countries is such that it's more profitable for folks in developing countries to do the disassembly of the electronics. And also, there might be more lax regulations there in terms of the environmental management of the products.
Right. Is there any concern that a lot of this stuff, particularly like phones and things like that, are ending up in landfills?
There is that concern, definitely. And there is some anecdotal evidence showing that some of these shipments certainly do end up in places in China, in Africa, in India. What we did is we used the best available nationwide data that we could get a hands on, and that was using trade data, because every export shipment that leaves the U.S. has a record associated with it. And if an exporter does a good job, they'll, you know, if they're shipping laptops, they'll check off the box that says this is a laptop. Unfortunately, currently, our trade codes don't differentiate between new and used laptops. So we had to use a mathematical algorithm to determine of the export shipments, which of those were used and which were new. But we found that actually using that trade data, and we consider our estimate to be a lower bound estimate, that really only a small fraction are being exported.
When you talk about reuse, you're not talking about, say, assistive technology, Ohio, which is wants to reuse these computers to reconfigure them for people who have disabilities. You're talking about commercial reuse, putting them back on the market as is or refurbished.
Yeah, there's a whole variety of ways that the equipment can be reused.
Okay.
The organization that you mentioned is certainly one of the means that happens. There's definitely charities all around the country that are interested in taking used electronics and repurposing them. And then also, if they're, you know, a new enough technology, then it still might have a reasonable resale value. So it's profitable for the electronics firms to, you know, even auction them off in bulk so that you can purchase, you know, pretty decent equipment that has been tuned up to be able to work with the latest operating systems, for example.
Some states have laws on electronic recycling. Ohio does not.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give us a little bit of an idea about what some of those laws look like?
Oh, I sure can. So half of the states currently have electronics recycling laws, starting off with California in 2003. And your neighbors, Michigan, Indiana, West Virginia, and Pennsylvania, all have recycling laws. In Ohio, there have been efforts in the past 2 years in the legislature to introduce laws, but they haven't gotten very far. Fortunately, Jason Linnell, our co-author from the National Center of Electronics Recycling, was mentioning that in Columbus, it's actually a real hotbed for electronics recycling activity, and there are several companies doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So around the country, there's basically there's a couple types of laws. Some are strictly an electronics landfill ban, so it means that you just waste collection companies can't pick up, for example, CRT monitors. But the most common is an extended producer responsibility law. And basically what that means is that the manufacturers are required to fund the recycling of the products in proportion with either how much they sold or how much was collected. But then California has a different style of financing where they actually charge consumers upfront a fee, which then goes into a pool to pay those recyclers at the end of life.
David in Granville, you're on the air. Hi, David.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Good. So I wanted to just briefly mention this idea that we're sending all these electronics overseas was sort of glossed over. The speaker did talk a little bit about how there's increased, or at least the industrial capacity to deal with these materials. But I think it's worth mentioning that in many cases, this material is being dealt with in such lax manner that they're actually creating extraordinarily toxic sites locally in other countries. And, you know, while we're talking about all the economic models related to recycling, we have to be aware of the hidden cost here. We're essentially exporting toxic waste and having other people potentially going to get sick with it.
Actually, Reed Miller, I thought you did bring that up.
Yeah, and I'll just touch on it again. Mm-hmm. Certainly, there's been a lot of concern in that arena, and there's a couple different fates when something is exported. Perhaps, like I mentioned, it might be processed in an industrial facility. Also, there's actually some capacity to properly manage electronics in other countries. There's a fair trade recycling organization that talks about geeks of color around the world who are pretty proficient at disassembling and repurposing used electronics. And then there's also the unfortunate situations where there are, as you mentioned, toxic piles of electronics accumulating in some specific areas, such as in southern Ghana and in some parts of China. So those are certainly issues that need to be addressed.
Should any of this have to do with our consumption? Should we think twice about whether we get the newest phone, the newest, laptop or the newest tablet? Is there a moral question here?
Well, you know, in when we're modeling how many electronics are going to be generated in a given year, it certainly has to do with the lifespan. And if an electronics lifespan can be extended, you know, the longer the better, because that will certainly result in fewer electronics being purchased, and any reuse that can happen to offset the purchase of new electronics will also help. So, I think those are certainly some considerations, as well as looking upstream at the manufacturers and seeing what they can do to increase the durability of their products and other innovative ways to extend the lifespan.
Versus what they try to do to increase the planned obsolescence of an electronic.
Yeah, certainly planned obsolescence is a problem in this space as well as many other commodity areas that in the U.S.
Is there much research into, the components and how to change them so that they're not so toxic?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's interest in what's called design for recycling and also design for disassembly. And there is, because of the global nature of electronics production, there have been more stringent toxics regulations coming out of Europe that we actually benefit from as consumers here. So we're seeing the RoHS, R-O-H-S laws that were implemented in Europe benefiting us because there are fewer toxics in our electronics. And also there's efforts to, for example, reduce how many screws it takes to unscrew a laptop so that you can more easily streamline the disassembly of them to increase the chances that it will be reused and that its components can be harvested.
When they have these computer drop-off things that they at the high school or someone will be doing it for a fundraiser, what happens to all of those? What do they do with them?
Yeah, those are going to be all collected up by a firm that's likely going to go through the sort of triage I described before, and they're going to decide, should I refurbish this and get it ready for reuse, or should I harvest its parts and resell those, or should I just send the whole thing through a shredder and get the commodity value out of that?
But they just pay sort of some kind of fixed amount or some kind of agreed upon amount to the fundraiser people, and that's that.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a variety of models. Some of them will actually charge you when you drop it off because in some cases, like a CRT, that's a cathode ray tube. So think of your older TVs that, you know, before flat screens and the older monitors, they have lead in them. And that actually makes it pretty difficult to manage. And there's very little production of them happening new around the world. So there's really not a demand for that glass terms of reincorporating it.
Yeah.
So we're actually seeing in some situations around the U.S. abandoned warehouses full of these things because it was too costly for the firm to manage them. So they just, you know, closed up shop and left it there for someone else. And so for those things, it's nice for the consumer to pay a fee because it's actually going to cost the company per pound to manage it versus if it's a nicer computer, then they'll be making a profit off of it. So sometimes those companies sort of expect that they'll do a little better than breaking even when they're gathering up whatever comes in when people drive through and drop it off.
Well, Reed Miller, I'd love to know where these warehouses are. But in the meantime, thanks for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks so much.
Reed Miller, he's a research specialist at MIT Materials Systems Lab. Coming up, we'll check in with Geek.com's Russell Holly to hear the final installment of his holiday tech gift guide. So stay with us. We'll be right back with Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. During the holiday season, a lot of attention is paid to the kids in our lives and what presents they'll find under the tree. But all the big kids want to get their hands on some cool gifts as well. Joining us now to tell us his gadget gift picks for the adults in your life is tech blogger Geek.com, Russell Holly. Welcome back, Russell.
Hey, thanks.
So in general, should we take everything you've said over the last 2 or 3 weeks and then add this on top of that?
If you have that many people in your life to shop for, then sure.
Well, the idea being that adults like the kids stuff too, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely some things for the kids, you know, there's no reason that adults can't enjoy them as well.
Okay. So let's see. Gosh, this is really something. Philips Hue bulbs that... you know, how could you get more boring than a light bulb for Christmas?
Really? I am utterly infatuated with these light bulbs right now, as silly as that seems. These are a whole lot more than just light bulbs. These are light bulbs that have individual wireless control systems using a technology called Zigbee on the inside. And what it allows you to do, You can replace your light bulbs in your house with these, and then you, from your phone or your tablet or your computer, you have complete control over how bright they are, their color temperature, how they respond during certain points of the day. I have driven my wife absolutely mad over the past week as I've been playing with them in our living room because there are even protocols in place so that they flash specific colors, like when you get an email. And I assume that most people get, you know, two or three emails a day that isn't like spam, but I get closer to like 200. So I had to turn that off pretty quickly. but there's so many really interesting things you can do with this. And there's been a lot of science in the last couple of years about the effect of color temperature from our light bulbs on our mood during certain points of the day. You know, you kind of want softer, warmer tones as you're getting closer to bed. Whereas, you know, harsher blue bulbs during certain points of the workday have been shown to kind of energize you and give you momentum. And what's cool about these bulbs is that you can set these color temperatures for specific times of the day, or if you've got one sitting next to you on the couch, you can set it specifically for optimal reading temperatures. You have just this fantastic array of control. And it can all be done from your phone or from your tablet. You can set it up so that as soon as you leave the house, as soon as the phone recognizes that you're no longer in your house, all the lights turn off across your house. I mean, it really does give you a phenomenal amount of control, but they are terribly expensive.
Okay, so, all right. So first, before we get to the price, what's an A19 bulb? What's a BR30 bulb? And do these bulbs look different than usual bulbs?
They definitely look different than usual bulbs because these are LEDs inside of special containers. So they're going to look a little different. And you should really make sure that you check the wattage. If you use things like, you know, the really bright 150-watt bulbs in your house, then these aren't ever going to be bright enough for you. I mean, they may make 150-watt equivalents down the road, but these are much closer to like 60-watt equivalent and 80-watt equivalent bulbs.
God, who uses 150-watt bulbs?
There are definitely fixtures that call for them still. I have one. I have exactly one in my house still. Wow. That requires a 150-watt bulb. Otherwise, it's mostly useless. But the A19 bulb and the B30 bulb, this refers to the type of fixture on the back and the kind of light that they put out. So the BR30 bulbs are more like the floodlights, where it's got that big dome that kind of cones out, and mm-hmm. then it points light in a specific position. Whereas A19 bulbs are much closer to they work much more closely to your kind of standard looking light bulb. So you would need to make sure that you can differentiate between the two. But then they also have LED strips, which are, you know, longer strips of just a strand of LED lights, not like Christmas lights, but sealed lights that you can stick under things that you would be able to control the same way.
Oh, and how does it work? Is it like a Bluetooth sort of thing with your phone app or your computer or what?
Well, so all of this happens over the wireless network in your house. This all relies on connectivity between this little sensor that you plug into the back of your wireless router and the lights in your house. It uses a wireless protocol called Zigbee. So it's not using like your internet Wi-Fi to actually send the color commands or anything like that, but uh-huh. it uses it to receive commands from your phone. So basically, you know, from your phone, you say, you know, turn all the lights down in the house, and it sends that command to this little disc that's plugged into the back of your wireless router, which then relays that command to the light bulbs using this protocol.
And you can set the lights to change with a timer. You can do it on the fly.
Oh, yeah. There's an incredible amount of control. The reason I was playing with it this week was to see if I could get it to work with Google Glass. And I terrified my children earlier this week by turning on my glass and saying a command into my glass and having it turn all the lights in their bedroom, this kind of blood red.
Oh my gosh.
You know, it's just kind of an experiment to see, like, you know, whether it would get them ready for school faster in the morning.
Well, it turns out
it does.
How many colors are there now that you blood red?
You have the complete color spectrum. When you set regular white, you know, white, yellow, or blue, you know, kind of color temperatures that you would see from normal light bulbs.
Uh-huh.
But you have access to another panel in that app that gives you the full color spectrum. If you want, you know, shades of blue or pink or purple or red, you have that entire color spectrum at your disposal at any time.
Okay, but at what cost?
So you have to purchase this starter kit, regardless of which kind of bulb you want. If you want the A19 bulbs or the B30 bulbs, And the starter kits themselves include three bulbs and the adapter, and those are $200. Each additional bulb that you purchase after that, which have to be purchased individually, are a separate $60 purchase.
And how long
do they
last?
They're very expensive light bulbs.
How long do they last?
LED light bulbs, in general, last a really long time.
Oh, okay.
So they so much longer than, you know, your standard light bulb. And I don't know what the actual life expectancy is on the Hue bulbs because there's a lot of extra technology in there, and you are pretty constantly messing with things like color and temperature and things like that. So it would stand to reason that they would be somewhat less than a regular LED bulb whose only job is to turn on and off, but I don't know that for sure.
So who would want a gift like this besides you?
Anybody who is interested in, you know, kind of home automation. I found it absolutely fascinating to, you know, for someone who lives on a schedule like I am, I'm always up at, you know, 6 o'clock. My kids are always up at 7 o'clock, and to be able to go and set certain things across my house so that, you know, things are, you know, automatically turning on and things are happening as soon as I come into the house. It's a fantastic amount of control that you have over what seems like really trivial things, but really have a positive effect on just kind of your general day-to-day life when you don't have to think about these things. They just happen.
Oh, boy, you sold me. The less I have to think about. okay, so moving on. Before we move on to the Ghostbuster particle thrower, we have an email from Sue. She asks if you can ask Russell whether I should buy a Nintendo 3DS or a 3DS XL if my daughter wants to play Pokemon on it. Thanks.
I would definitely say the XL if you're going to specifically get one that has 3DS capabilities just because it's the larger screen. But you should also consider the 2DS. If the 3D technology is not important to you.
Okay, thank you for that. Now, on to the Ghostbuster particle thrower. I don't know. So the way the script was written for me is now from the practical to the almost silly, and I'm still thinking those bulbs are wow. But let's talk about the new toy for the big kids from Mattel, the Ghostbuster neutrino wand. What is this?
So this is... This I intentionally put in there because it was very silly. It's really more of a collector's item than anything else. But I figured that I was probably approaching the correct age demographic where Ghostbusters was cool.
Oh yeah.
You know, so it was one of those things that when I saw it, it was really interesting. Mattel has been over the last year releasing officially licensed replicas of the you know tech and toys that were seen in the Ghostbusters movies. And this is the gun that was used to take down the ghosts in the movies.
Okay.
It was the thing that was attached to the backpack, and you know all of the Ghostbusters had it and used it to lasso the ghosts and put them in the box. And this has been meticulously made with the company that originally made the fittings for the movie prop. They actually got licensing from the company that was responsible for all of the metal fittings and stuff for the original. But this version is made of plastic, and all of the lights and sounds from it have been recorded straight from the movie. So it ends up being, you know, a big kid's toy, you know, an adult's toy for you know, adults who remember and were huge fans of the movies, to be able to just kind of put on a shelf somewhere. But when you take it down to play with it, it really does work and sound just like what you would remember from the movie.
It actually busts up ghosts.
I would assume, you know, having not had the chance to try it up against any ghosts.
Okay, so
I would assume that it works just fine.
Okay, but you have tried this.
I have, yeah. It's actually kind of funny. You know, it doesn't connect to like a backpack, so it's you kind of have to supply
yeah.
your own.
Okay.
I don't mean to bum anybody out, but you know, I didn't have any ghosts around at the you know to try it out on, but it was definitely, you know, it sounded perfectly authentic. And you know, one of the big things from the movie was, you know, don't cross the streams. Don't take the two wands and pass them across each other. With this toy, if you do so, you know, if you have someone else, if you happen to have someone else who is as big a Ghostbusters nerd as you are, and you both own one and you point them at each other, they do something completely unique. You know, they kind of pulse and vibrate and make fun noises. So it was really interesting to see, you know, kind of that aspect of
the movie come to, you know, kind of the collector life.
All right. So it makes, sounds like it'd make a great costume, accoutrement, but is this something you just put up
really
on your gun rack
where,
or what?
You know, you could have it sit on a shelf somewhere, and you know, people who are Ghostbusters fans will immediately recognize what it is. I mean, it's like, you know, one of the swords from Game of Thrones or, you know, Lord of the Rings or any of those things. This is the same kind of thing.
Okay.
Where a collector would get, you know, and just kind of have on display.
How much does it cost?
They are $130 for the replica. And they're going to be sold by Mattel. Actually, last week. They started selling them last week.
What do you go to, like, Toys R Us to get them or what?
No. So Mattel has a specific website for the Ghostbusters fans. And the URL is unfortunately too long to read.
Okay, that's okay. That's okay. We'll find the link to it and post it on our website at wosu.org/outsides. Save people some time. But, wow, I'm telling you, the way they drill down into some of these concepts, is, I'm sure I'm in the right business. Let's put it that way. Google Chromecast. We've talked about Google Chromecast on the show before, but remind us what it is, how it works, what's the deal?
So this is a tiny HDMI stick that you plug into the back of any television. You connect it to a wireless network, and if you have a laptop, an iPhone, an Android phone, a tablet, you can use it to wirelessly receive video from so many different sources now. You can use it to receive music. You can use it to receive video from Netflix or you know, YouTube or just a ton of different resources now. And they're $30. Every Best Buy has them for $30. They are really just the perfect gift for anybody who enjoys watching things digitally. You know, people who enjoy Netflix or enjoy HBO or you know, any of those services, you know, instead of having to wait for that information, you know, to be able to just watch it, you know, at your own pace instead of having like a DVR or something like that. I use mine constantly, and everyone that I've ever gifted one to has really appreciated it as well.
It sounds like the perfect stocking stuffer.
Absolutely. It is, in fact, also small enough to go into a stocking.
See? And would you would choose it over something like Roku or Apple TV or something like that?
I would absolutely choose it over an Apple TV. Some Roku users have, you know, really specific needs because it allows for local network transfer,
yeah,
which is really kind of technical stuff. So that it may not apply to every Roku user,
mm-hmm.
But for what I use a Roku for, I definitely unplugged my Roku and replaced it with this device.
Okay, so the Google Chromecast, about $30. You can get it at any Best Buy. That's the stocking stuffer. Moto X.
Yeah, so, you know,
at
this
your
time
top
of year,
smartphone.
I always have someone ask me, you know, what's the best smartphone on the market? What's the best tablet on the market? And it usually ends up this kind of long conversation where I learn about the person before I make a recommendation.
Okay.
But because I can't do that on the radio, I figured I would just say the ones that I thought were the best.
Okay.
The best smartphone this year, I think, hands down, was Motorola's Moto X. It is a 4.7-inch screen. It is really fast, and it has some of the coolest features as far as, you know, hands-free controls and being able to receive your notifications. They're completely unique to this phone. And I thought it was just remarkably well done. And the best tablet, in my opinion, is the new iPad mini with Retina display.
Why? Just because of the Retina display or the size?
Well,
you've liked the size all along. You've been approving of that.
I am. I'm a big fan of the 8-inch or 7-inch tablets. This one is a little more expensive than, say, Google's Nexus 7, but the display on this thing is phenomenal. Apple's, you know, entire ecosystem, if you're familiar with it, then you already know that it's, you know, it's a great thing to invest in.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's really just one of those things that if you're looking for a tablet and you don't necessarily want a big 10-inch tablet, then my personal recommendation would be the iPad mini with Retina display.
Russell Holly, I hope you have a wonderful holiday and Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Well, thank you, and the same to you.
Thanks for all of your wonderful ideas. Thanks for joining us today. Thanks to everybody for listening. If you want to listen back to Russell's other suggestions for gifts this year, you can go back to our other shows. They're in our archive at wosu.org/allsides. Thanks again for listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.